This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello and welcome back to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 24th episode. Today, we tackle a secondary analysis of a series of RCTs from the JCENM that introduces new ideas into the treatment and monitoring of male hypogonadism. We will walk through the methodology and results carefully, but try to stay at a somewhat high level as the investigators use a relatively unusual statistical approach that generates complicated findings. As always, we will end with considering whether this study should change our practice. First, a few quick introductions for our group today. I am a general endocrinologist at Vanderbilt, Nashville, Tennessee, where I additionally work as the medical director for our clinics and as one of the associate program directors for our fellowship. Joining me again today for the third time as our regular contributor is Rich Comey from Dartmouth in Lebanon, New Hampshire. Rich also works as a general endocrinologist and brings with him many decades of experience in education, having served separately as the director of the internal medicine residency and the endocrinology fellowship at Dartmouth for many years. Our guest expert today is Mathis Grossman from the University of Melbourne in Australia. Mathis is an internationally recognized expert in male hypogonadism with great clinical expertise in this area and numerous publications ranging from basic science to clinical management. He is a consultant endocrinologist at Austin Health, where he runs the Endocrine Men's Health Clinic. Additionally, he serves on several editorial boards, including the two journals this podcast reviews, the JCENM and the JES. As you can all tell, I have two excellent endocrinologists joining me today to dissect this article, and I welcome them both. As is also always the case, everything we discuss is our opinions only and not of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. Today, we look at relation of testosterone, dihydrotestosterone, and estradiol with changes in outcomes measures in the testosterone trials, which is a forthcoming article in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Alyssa Stephen Shield served as the first author for this paper that came to us from the University of Pennsylvania and the Brigham and Women's Hospital at Harvard. At this point, Rich will review the author's introduction and get Mathis to highlight several key aspects of the treatment of male hypogonadism. Rich?
Thank you very much, Chase. So this is a paper that really seeks to identify the components of the hormonal changes that are wrought by testosterone gel therapy and linking them with really specific outcomes. We all know that circulating testosterone is converted in peripheral tissues to two metabolites, dihydrotestosterone and estradiol, with presumably different effects on different target organs. So the physiology of testosterone is very important to understanding this paper. Maybe Dr. Grossman can maybe just review a little bit of it.
Thank you, Rich. As you pointed out, in men, testosterone is both a hormone and a prohormone, and testosterone is sometimes referred to as three hormones in one. And over the recent years, it has become increasingly clear that some of the biologic actions of testosterone in men are not directly mediated by a testosterone activating the androgen receptor, but in fact are indirect via the action of its two principal metabolites, dihydrotestosterone, or DHT, and estradiol. DHT activates the androgen receptor with, on a molar basis, actually a higher potency than testosterone itself. DHT is mostly produced inside cells, and theologically, DHT is speculated to have evolved as a local amplification system of androgen action to allow targeted androgenic action to certain tissues that need it, without exposing the rest of the body to unnecessarily high androgen action. And this is particularly evident during development, where DHT is required for masculinization of the urogenital sinus and the genital tubercle, which give rise to, for example, the prostate and the phallus. So genetic males with a deficiency in 5-alpha reductase, the enzyme that converts testosterone to DHT, are born with genital ambiguity and may initially be raised as females, but when testosterone increases in puberty, experience marked virilization, including phallic growth, normal testis development, and spermatogenesis. And there's a really good Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by the American author Jeffrey Eugenides called Middlesex, which I recommend you read in your spare time, which is set in the 1950s in Detroit and chronicles the tribulations of the protagonist who has 5-alpha reductase deficiency and is born into a conservative Greek immigrant family. So in addition to DHT, testosterone is also converted to estradiol by the enzyme aromatase, and men actually have higher circulating estradiol concentration than postmenopausal women. Estradiol has important biologic actions in men, and it is now accepted that some of the clinical features of male hypogonadism are not mediated by testosterone deficiency, but rather by estradiol deficiency, including, for example, effects on fat mass, the skeleton, sexual function, and hot flushes. And we'll come back to this in our study today. And evidence for this really comes from a variety of different strains of clinical investigation, as well as mechanistic investigations, including gene deletion experiments in mice, rare case reports of men with congenital aromatase or estrogen receptor deficiency, as well as from Mendelian randomization studies, clinical trials, and physiologic studies in men with experimental manipulation of hormone concentrations.
That was great. So it turns out the authors point out in their introduction that there are two sort of variables that one might also consider, which is that the rates of conversion of testosterone to dihydrotestosterone and estradiol may vary depending on genetic polymorphisms, so that linking these metabolites to outcomes may have some real clinical relevance. In addition, it turns out that treating men with hypogonadism with testosterone gels, which many of us prescribe, leads to a relatively higher amount of DHT than treatment with injectable testosterone because there's L5-alpha reductase action in the skin. So I don't know, Dr. Grossman, you want to just comment on those two sort of features?
Yes, it's an interesting point. Ultimately, this is difficult to predict given that there are no head-to-head clinical studies comparing the effects of topical versus injectable testosterone preparations on clinically important outcomes. And I guess even if they were, it would be hard to disentangle DHT-specific effects from that of testosterone or estradiol exposure, which may also differ between the two preparations. So interestingly, in this context, Shelley Basine's group, who conducted the work featured in today's article, did an experimental study, which was published back in the JAMA in about 2012, to tease out whether conversion to DHT is required to mediate the biologic actions of testosterone. And to do this, they gave GnRH analogs to suppress endogenous sex steroid productions in healthy men. The men were then given graded doses of injectable testosterone and enanthate add-back plus either the 5-alpha reductase inhibitor dutasteride or placebo. And in this study, between the two groups, there was no difference in lean mass, the primary outcome, as well as in secondary outcomes such as fat mass, sexual function, hematocrit, and lipid concentrations between dutasteride and placebo-treated men, suggesting really that the conversion of testosterone to DHT is not essential for mediating these biological effects, at least. And based on roles of DHT in adults and the clinical experience with 5-alpha reductase inhibitors, one might expect differential effects of topical versus injectable testosterone predominantly on prostate and perhaps androgenic alopecia, although this is a hypothesis that remains to be tested in clinical trials.
So all this is very interesting to those of us who treat, of course, hypogonadal men with testosterone frequently. And, you know, as we're all knows, monitoring of testosterone replacement therapy in men really focuses nearly exclusively on testosterone levels, not on estradiol or DHT levels. So this study really seeks to see if those metabolites might even be part of clinical monitoring. So the study itself, though, is a secondary analysis of treatment arms of a prior set of trials, the TT trials, to assess the associations of total testosterone, estradiol, and DHT on five relatively hard endpoints: hemoglobin, HDL, vertebral bone mineral density, sexual desire, and the PSA levels, and the study looked at the changes in those five parameters that were wrought by the treatment.
Good, thanks, Rich. That really nicely sets things up, I think, and we always like these studies that really challenge us to think about things differently and say, have we decided we've fixated on a particular way things have to be, and then help us think about, well, maybe that's not the right way to do that. So we're going to get into the methods. The first thing that I want to do, though, it's been mentioned that this is a secondary analysis of a set of RCTs. So we're going to start with describing again what RCTs are, just to make sure that everybody's on the same page. We'll think a little bit more about how a secondary analysis needs to modify our thinking there, but to start with a randomized control trial, there are several reasons that those are considered to be the gold standard. And it's really that they effectively deal with biases and confounders. So those are things that we frequently think about. We usually review observational studies in this podcast, and those are frequent issues that we have to consider. And as a reminder, the biases are in medical research or when one group, a treated group versus a non-treated group, is treated differently purely because either the subjects themselves or the investigators know that they have been treated with something or have been exposed to something, more generally speaking, as opposed to not. And what makes these so effective, the RCTs, is that when they are blinded, neither the subjects nor the investigators know whether you have been exposed or not. And so that's a real strength of those. Confounders is the other thing that we have to think about. And RCTs deal with confounders a little bit differently. It's not that they get rid of them. It's that if the randomization is done well and the group is large enough, then those confounders are balanced between all the groups, or at a minimum, the two groups that are involved, so that they essentially, and from a statistical sense, cancel each other out. They're still there, they still have their effects, but because they're the same in each group, you don't have to worry about them skewing the conclusions that you're coming to. So that's why RCTs are considered the gold standard. And we're going to come back to that in a second when we think about how this secondary analysis is set up and what aspects of those we may lose, and then where we need to be careful and not just automatically transfer all those benefits to this secondary analysis. But first, I want us to think a little bit more about the testosterone trials. Rich mentioned this is a secondary analysis of this. This is where it's coming from. So I wanted to start with Mathis just giving us a real high-level overview about these testosterone trials. How did they work, and why were they so important in us understanding how hypogonadism should be treated?
So it was a multi-site study which comprised seven trials. So it's a little complicated, but I'll try to tease it out as best as I can. They recruited men who are 65 years or older, and they had to have on at least two occasions a testosterone concentration of less than 275 nanograms per deciliter and at least one symptom consistent with androgen deficiency, and were randomly allocated to testosterone gel, and it was titrated according to concentrations with blinded titration of the placebo group as well for 1 year. So it's the largest testosterone trial done in men with so-called functional, or sometimes referred to as late onset hypogonadism. And it is important to note that men with organic hypogonadism, so established pituitary or testicular disease where there is no controversy regarding testosterone replacement, were excluded from the study. Interestingly, men that are eligible for the T trials are actually quite hard to find. And the primary investigator during one of his US endo talks quipped that it was harder to get into the trial than into Harvard Medical School, needing to screen more than 50,000 men to ultimately enroll 790 participants. And so in the main trial, testosterone treatment in these men improved most aspects of sexual function modestly, with effect sizes between 0.3 to 0.4. So moderate effect sizes was particularly effective on libido and overall sexual activity, but somewhat less on erectile dysfunction, because erectile dysfunction is commonly due to neurovascular disease rather than testosterone deficiency itself. And testosterone is well known to be less effective than a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. In the T trials, testosterone had no effect on vitality or cognition, but slightly improved mood. In sub-studies that were done in a smaller group of patients, testosterone treatment improved volumetric bone density and estimated bone strength, with effect sizes similar to that what would be expected from bisphosphonates. Testosterone also improved hemoglobin in men with anemia, and improved self-reported physical function and mobility, but did not reduce falls. And interestingly, testosterone treatment was associated with increased in cardiac atheroma, especially with an increase in non-calcified plaque volume, which was somewhat unexpected, but the T-trials were not powered to assess the effect of testosterone treatment on heart outcomes such as cardiovascular and prostate events or on fractures. So overall, the benefits were predominantly seen on sexual function, especially libido and overall activity and bone density and anemia. These were the most clear-cut outcomes, with the long-term risks still somewhat uncertain. And hopefully the TRAVERSE study, a placebo-controlled testosterone trial, which has enrolled about 5,000 US men, given again topical testosterone or placebo for up to 5 years, will give some answers, as the primary outcome in TRAVERSE will be MACE, or major adverse cardiovascular events. And the study has probably ended recruitment with results expected this year or the next year.
Good, thank you. So that helps outline the basic trial here, the study, this testosterone trial, since that helps us understand why that was important and how that affected our thinking about the treatment of hypogonadism. So what this secondary analysis did is it looked at only the treatment arm. So Mathis described you have a treated group and you have a placebo group. This secondary analysis focused on the 394 treated men. And the way that I would describe that, it certainly is a secondary analysis, but as you think about it, based on the study design, it functions a bit more like a retrospective cohort study in the sense that all of these individuals are treated. And while we're still looking at the same outcomes, which we'll review in just a second, the exposures in this are different because the exposure is not where you treated with testosterone, because all of these individuals, all these men were treated with testosterone. And the exposures, as we think about them, are the hormone levels that were talked about already. So the total testosterone, as was mentioned, but also the estradiol and the DHT levels. And it's specifically those changes in those levels over time and how that drives the outcomes. And so there's going to be different things that we have to think about there. And so we're going to consider that a little bit further, but I think an important thing to highlight early on. So to highlight again, the outcome measures that were talked about, and it is a change from baseline to 12 months and the five things that Rich previously mentioned. So hemoglobin, HDL cholesterol, the volumetric BMD of the lumbar spine that was measured with quantitative CT, the PSA level, and then also the measure of sexual desire. And that was measured with a derogatus interview for sexual function too. And so what I wanted to do is stop for just a little bit and think about other things that might have been nice to know. So a limitation of any of these retrospective studies is you're stuck with whatever data is available. You can't go back and collect new data for the most part. And just to think about other things that we would like to know, or were these chosen just simply because they're easy to measure and actually maybe isn't really what we want to know? And Mitch, Rick, maybe we'll start with you. So I know you had mentioned some perhaps with bones, having other markers of bone turnover might be helpful. But Rich, what other thoughts, other information might have been helpful to know here if we had access to it?
Well, you know, as a clinician who sees people who have this problem, which is they have a low testosterone, it's a functional low testosterone, a lot of them have a lot of subjective complaints. And in some ways, it would have been nice to have some sort of attempt at more than just sexual desire as a subjective complaint and get it analyzed. Admittedly, that's a very hard thing to measure accurately, but it would have been a great use to a clinician who's sort of taking care of this. That was probably the biggest issue that I saw that would have been very nice to sort of have as well.
Good. Mathis, any thoughts that you have, other information that would have been nice to know if it had been available for these investigators?
Yes, I guess, as you pointed out, the bone markers also easily quantifiable and known to be predominantly associated with estradiol deficiency. I don't think they were measured in the T trials, so obviously they're not available. Some other features that would be nice to have known: lean mass, that's clearly related to testosterone, and fat mass is clearly estradiol dependent based on studies that Joel Finkelstein did, for example, where he chose young, healthy men and he used GnRH analogs to suppress endogenous sex steroid completely and then gave graded add-back of testosterone. But then those men were further divided into two groups, where one group received an aromatase inhibitor and the other group received placebo. And so by that way, he was able to infer the actions of estradiol by comparing the different groups. So, for example, in the man that he gave graded at back of testosterone, lean mass increased irrespective of the fact whether they were randomized to an aromatase inhibitor or not. So then concluding that effects of testosterone on lean mass are directly mediated by testosterone, whereas in the men who, when he looked at fat mass, the men who were given testosterone had reductions in fat mass, and those were not seen in the men who also had an aromatase inhibitor, therefore concluding that estradiol really is required for mediating effects on fat mass in men with hypogonadism. So it would be interesting to have lean mass and fat mass, but although DEXA was performed in the key trials, that was not available. The other aspect that could have been looked at was cardiac atheroma, but the authors, I think, in the paper mentioned that the data were too few to analyze, because cardiac atheroma and cardiovascular events is really a big issue with testosterone treatment. Some other markers that they did publish on, but only showed modest effects, would have been glucose, insulin, HbA1c, so measures of glucose metabolism, but they were not analyzed in this study.
Good. And we'll stay with you, Mathis, with the next question. And the authors provide a really nice detailed description of both the lab approaches, the methodology that they use, and also the imaging that they used. And we won't go through the details of that, as it is relatively detailed. But why don't you just give us your thoughts on that? Any concerns that you had for how labs were measured or how imaging was done, or all looked pretty standard and no major concerns for how it was done in those trials compared to what we say might do if those trials were started today?
Well, I think the authors are really ought to be commended for using accurate state-of-the-art methodology. So a lot of papers in our field are, for example, measuring sex steroid concentrations by immunoassay, which can sometimes be clinically validated, but they're not the gold standard anymore. So this paper used liquid chromatography tandem mass spectrometry, or LCMS-MS, which not only was used, but also linked to a CDC certified quality control program. So it's really the gold standard technology, which makes these hormones quantifiable very reliably. And I guess volumetric BMD by quantitative CT, that's a good way to analyze bone. It might be important to point out that they did not use high-resolution peripheral quantitative CT, which has a higher resolution than quantitative CT used in this study. And with high-resolution quantitative CT, you can better discriminate cortical from trabecular bone.
So next to the statistics, and we're going to talk about this briefly, but the authors use a somewhat unusual approach to how to understand this connection. So again, the exposures that we're thinking about is all of these men are treated with testosterone. So the exposures are the changes in those three hormones, the total testosterone, the estradiol, and the DHT, and then looking at the changes in those five outcomes. And the model that they chose was a random forest method. And then they describe it both here and then also later in the discussions, the strength of that, why they did that. But they thought it worked really well so that they could see the interrelationship between those exposures, those three different hormone levels, how they changed over time, and then how the outcomes changed over time in relationship to that, so they could explore that a little bit more. We're going to think about that. That has some implications because it does generate some fairly complicated results with that methodology. So we'll actually dive into that a little bit more as Rich walks us through the results here in just a second. But one final word, and what I would describe as confounders here, we mentioned that earlier, but I think we have to start thinking about that, because once you do these secondary analysis, you lose any clear benefit of the randomization because the subgroups themselves are not randomized. And though the authors didn't use this terminology because it's a secondary analysis, essentially they did some adjustment for that, specifically that they assessed and made some adjustments for baseline values of each of those three hormones and also the outcomes as well, to try to get a sense of if that had an impact in addition to the change, which was actually being studied itself. And so I'll ask the group before we wrap up with the methods, any thoughts anyone has on the statistics that are used here, particularly around the confounders and how this functions as a secondary analysis, that we need to keep in mind as we consider these results here in just a second.
All these men had at least one symptom. And I've always wondered whether there might be symptom groups within this group, and they didn't sort of analyze that as a possible confounder.
And Mathis, your thoughts?
That's a good point, which perhaps some factors such as age would have been nice to adjust for, particularly given the fact that older men are more susceptible for example, experience erythrocytosis with testosterone and potentially BMI, as this may affect testosterone and estradiol concentrations. But the problem, I guess, is that how the men were chosen, their age ranges and BMI ranges were fairly narrow. And I think if they had put in confounders, they probably would have made the statistical analysis more complicated and might have lost some of the statistical significance of their results.
Good, and that actually sets us up nicely because the results are a bit complicated to grapple with as it is. So I'm turning it back over to Rich. He's going to walk us through that again. We're going to try to stay at a relatively high level, but dive into it deep enough to where we can really understand and grapple with some of those issues. So Rich, why don't you start walking us through the results as presented by the authors here?
As Chase mentioned, there were 394 men. Their average age was 72.1, plus or minus 5.7 years, so an older group. And about 63.6% of them had body mass indexes greater than 30, so there was a fair amount of obesity in this group. So the baseline levels of the three variables, as Chase mentioned, the big variable here is the change that would occur. So testosterone, which started at a 231.8 nanograms per deciliter, actually increased by more than that. It increased by 323.9 nanograms per deciliter on average. So that's a pretty big change. The estradiol, which started out at 20.3 picograms per mil, increased on average by 16.2 picograms per mil. So again, a pretty robust change in estradiol levels. And the dihydrotestosterone, which started out at 21.2 nanograms per deciliter, increased by a lot, by 86.4 nanograms per deciliter. So they had very large changes in all of these three parameters to use them as what they were going to measure and compare to changes in their outcomes. So that's actually a positive for them. And I think the takeaway is that all three hormones changed dramatically with this treatment, even though actually they started out at relatively mildly low average testosterone levels.
It certainly is a potential limitation. This was, I know that the testosterone trials overall is relatively mild levels of testosterone deficiency that are reported here. And so there's this ongoing concern. I know it always comes up as we wonder how well that these results can be extrapolated to men with more substantial hypogonadism. Matt has mentioned that they didn't include folks who had clear pituitary or testicular deficits here. And so I agree with Rich from your comments earlier is that you know, it does make us wonder if we look at that at those baseline levels, how easily applicable that's going to be to other patients that we may see.
Yeah. And in a different paper, the authors noted that there was really no threshold baseline testosterone for sexual dysfunction, suggesting if such a threshold exists, it would be lower than the baseline concentration in the T trial, so lower than 230. And interestingly, Joel Finkelstein published a paper in JCNM back in, I think, 2020, where again he gave GnRH analogs to suppress endogenous sex steroid concentrations in older men and then gave them graded testosterone add-back to determine testosterone serum thresholds below which features associated with hypogonadism may manifest. And in this study among healthy older men, so not obese and like in the T trials, did not have diabetes, in the T trials, 30% had diabetes. So in this older healthy men, in fact, the threshold for erectile dysfunction or sexual function in general was much lower, around a cutoff of 100 nanograms per deciliter, so much lower than in the testosterone trials. On the other hand, it's clear that the effects of testosterone do extend into the pharmacological range. For example, in experimental studies of graded testosterone add-back, again in older men, certain outcomes such as lean mass or hematocrit extended well into the supraphysiologic range. And we've done a study in Australia, which is the largest testosterone trial in the world, where we gave about 1,000 men testosterone to determine whether this would reduce the risk of diabetes. And it did by 40% on the top of a lifestyle program alone. And in this trial in T40M, testosterone treatment improved sexual function, despite the fact that in the men, the baseline testosterone, again by LCMS, was about 400 nanograms per deciliter. So even higher than in the T trials, the effect was not dependent on baseline testosterone, indicating that the effect was pharmacological. So in a broader sense, in men with organic hypogonadism, we give testosterone replacement therapy, and although there are no clinical randomized controlled trials and never will be, because it's considered unethical to submit men with organic hypogonadism to placebo, in the older men without organic hypogonadism, men such in the T trials, what we're really talking about is not testosterone replacement therapy strictly, but probably using the more neutral term of testosterone treatment is more reasonable. And as Chase, you pointed out, any pharmacological intervention such as testosterone therapy then has to be subjected to randomized controlled clinical trials.
So just going on with the results, this could really turn into a number salad pretty quickly if we just tried to give every piece of information this paper gave. So I'm going to give a very high-level view of these. First, to just go over the five outcomes they looked at. Looking at changes in hemoglobin, estradiol had the greatest effect. There was actually very little effect from dihydrotestosterone and really no effect seen from testosterone. Looking at changes, mainly decrease in HDL, there was a weak association with all three hormones, but estradiol would have had the biggest effect. Looking at the volumetric bone mineral density, estradiol again had the greatest effect, and there was some effect from dihydrotestosterone at high levels. Looking at changes in sexual desire, again, estradiol had the greatest effect. Dihydrotestosterone had some impact, but testosterone had very little. And then looking at changes in PSA, there was really no consistent way within those changes with the changes in these three hormones. So you can see that estradiol seemed to have very big effects. Its changes had big effect in changes in all five, almost all, four out of the five parameters. I will comment that the authors had a very complex conversation about the shapes of the curves plotted as change of effect versus change in the hormone. And the shapes of those relationships changed depending on whether there were high or low levels of the other hormones. So it got very complicated. For example, the effects on hemoglobin from dihydrotestosterone were greater if there was a high level of high level of change in the estradiol. So there was complex interrelationship of these. But again, looking at the major effects they looked at, estradiol had the greatest effect on hemoglobin, HDL, volumetric bone density, and actual sexual desire, some of which is actually surprising, which I guess we'll get to. Finally, they looked at pseudo R-square values. The values were 0.27 to 0.2, which is a reasonable sort of small but reasonable effect of relationship between the changes in the variables and the changes in the outcome.
And so before we move on to the discussion then, as Rich pointed out, so some of these R-square values were somewhat helpful here, I think, particularly around the BMD. It was about the 0.27. It was the PSA that we've commented on before, didn't really see much at all. It was just a 0.02. So explaining very little of the change in PSA was related at all to these hormone levels. But Mathis, when you look at these, I think the authors really struggled to come up with nice, consistent, succinct ways of describing these relationships. And then I think that was just the data that they were dealing with. Any thoughts that you would have as you look at this complex relationship and how difficult that is to summarize on the implications of that itself?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it was a complex paper. I think one of the issues is that we all know if we give topical testosterone treatment, there simply are very substantial variations in hormonal concentrations, not only of testosterone in itself, which can vary by more than 30% on a given day, but probably also in DHT and estradiol. This is partially due to variability in absorption. I think although the authors used complex statistical methods to deal with the issue of multicollinearity, it's clear that testosterone, estradiol, and DHT are interrelated because ultimately DHT and estradiol are both derived from testosterone. And the study wasn't really specifically designed. It was a retrospective study. It was not necessarily pre-specified in the statistical analysis plan. So the data are hypothesis generating, but I don't think they're definitive for this reason.
Good. Anyway, we're going to come back to that and think about that as what next steps would be as far as understanding that. So now we'll take a look at the discussions and the conclusions that the authors have. And so we'll start with their main conclusions. And then the way that they state is that the changes in these three hormones, again, the total testosterone, the estradiol, and DHT, that the changes in those three hormones are associated in a complex manner to the five measured outcomes. And we've described that a little bit and kind of find it hard to summarize that succinctly, but definitely the relationships that they saw there. One thing, though, that was a little bit unusual that Rich alluded to was the effect of estradiol. So the authors point out in their discussion that estradiol predicted changes in the BMD and also sexual desire. Those were expected. So that's been described before. Mathis mentioned that already. That was not something that was surprising to see. What was a little bit unusual was that it really seemed to be the big driver, or at least was clearly associated more than the other two hormones, with the hemoglobin changes and also the HDL lowering. And so I wanted us to stop and think about that just a little bit. Whenever we think about observational trials, as I would classify this secondary analysis, is we have to go through a series of criteria to try to understand how likely it is that this represents what's going on, the conclusions that have been drawn here. The Hill criteria is one well-known way, a lens of considering observational trials. And one of those is talking about biologic plausibility. And the idea with that is to say, well, whenever we see these findings, can we explain it by what we know already about biology? Does that fit with our understanding? All of these Hill criteria are suggestions. There's problems with all of them, and one of them are sometimes it's our clinical research that actually helps us later figure out biologic mechanisms that we didn't understand before. So we certainly can't claim that we know everything about underlying biology here. But I do think it raises some concerns with this paper is that they're very unexpected findings, and the authors do pull in other studies, including some basic science investigations, to try to explain that. But I think they still really struggle to try to come up with a good explanation for these hemoglobin and HDL changes. But Mathis, maybe we'll get your thoughts on that. With that finding, did you were able to be satisfied with the explanation that the authors presented there, or do you think it's not that big a deal or major problem? How would you view those that particular finding that the estradiol seems to be the main factor related to hemoglobin and HDL?
Well, yes, Chase, I think you raised some good points. In fact, my fellow just wrote a review article on hematologic actions of androgens and estrogens, which is in press in the Best Practice and Research Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism Journal. And you know, we reviewed the evidence, and I think the effects of estradiol on hemoglobin are very unexpected, and they're not really well supported by most of the clinical evidence. And that's, I think, while the authors who are well aware of the literature struggled a little to come up with a biological plausibility. So we know, for example, that erythropoiesis and increased hemoglobin hemocreatin is a very significant adverse effect with non-aromatizable androgens, so androgens that cannot be converted to estradiol, especially as we all see in the context of anabolic steroid use. And in fact, non-aromatizable androgens were actually used to treat anemia before the availability of drugs such as erythropoietin. There are also interesting experiments in men who are aromatase deficient, who lack estradiol. And if you treat those men with testosterone treatment, you see increased erythropoiesis, but you don't see erythropoiesis increase with estradiol treatment. And you know, other examples are women with congenital adrenal hyperplasia who have increased androgens if they're not treated properly, and they also develop erythrocytosis. Whether estradiol has an effect on hemoglobin is really not very well studied. There are some preclinical basic science experiments that are contradictory, but overall, I think the result is very unexpected and is not really compatible with what we see in clinical practice. similarly with HDL, I would think that most of the data, again, the example of anabolic steroids, especially non-aromatizable androgens, showing decreases in HDL. And we've recently done a study in men with prostate cancer who receive androgen deprivation therapy, so who have no testosterone and estradiol essentially. And we gave estradiol add back to these men in the context of randomized controlled clinical trial. And we haven't seen any effect on lipids, but we haven't analyzed hemoglobin yet. And so, you know, prompted by this study and looking what future studies might be helpful to evaluate this further, I think we'll look at our hemoglobin results, because this was a randomized controlled clinical trial where the effects of estradiol are studied in the absence of testosterone, given the background ADT that these men with prostate cancer receive. So this, you know, is a good example and inspires me to look at these results, because we do have the hemoglobin results.
So we'll actually come back to that question of, well, what other data might be needed here? We have some questions, doesn't totally fit well with what we understand from the rest of the medical literature. So where do we go from here? So we'll come back to that at the end. So first of all, I want to review how the authors describe their strengths and limitations of this investigation. So first of all, they point out that this is, as a secondary analysis, was done of the largest clinical trials of testosterone therapy. And they, just as Matt has pointed out, that they pointed a strength of their paper, their approach was using a validated methodology for the lab, so the liquid chromatography mass spec, and that was the gold standard. So that's another strength of that. They also point out that their outcome measurement is a strength of their paper, that they use 5 measures that are reported continuously and then also are measured precisely and accurately. And finally, that their statistical methodology, while somewhat complicated, it does really work well with continuous variables, and so allow them to make the most sense of some complicated data. A couple of limitations are that they point out that they do acknowledge that their R squared values are modest, that the best one at 0.27 really just explains a relatively small amount of the changes that are observed, and all the way down to that PSA of 0.02 really don't explain anything there. So some modest, a lot of other factors, those unexplained confounders that may be driving the outcomes here that we still don't really understand what those are. And then finally, and we've talked about this before, as they point out that this is true for the basic RCT itself, is that the results may not be generalizable to either younger men or those with more severe hypogonadism. So finally, with what the authors say, a couple of conclusions that I want to quote of theirs that we're going to grapple with a little bit. So first of all, they state that our findings suggest that consideration of all 3 sex hormones offers a superior prediction of treatment response, and that further validation of these findings in other studies could provide the scientific rationale for measuring DHT and estradiol. So I want us to wrestle with those a little bit more. So first of all, we'll come to whether this will change our practice here in a second. But I want us to think about the quality of this report overall, specifically those low R-squared values, kind of having trouble with that biologic plausibility, other things that were mentioned early on as well. This actually may be specific to the testosterone formulation, the gel, and it's hard to know if that's true for, say, injectable testosterone. But Rich, why don't we get your thoughts on this, just the quality of this report overall. What are your thoughts on this and what this adds to the medical literature?
Well, you know, I certainly think the authors did as much as they could do with the data they had. That, you know, this was a retrospective, basically data that was already collected, and they were trying to make some sense out of all of this. I thought the study was very interesting and provocative, and that it really suggested, again, estradiol having a big role. But like Matthew said, I thought it was more hypothesis generating than actually conclusive. One thing I'd love to hear a comment on is it struck me once that I saw a very unusual result, like the hemoglobin result. If there were no receptors for estradiol on cells that made hemoglobin, would this have looked the same? Because they were looking at changes in the estradiol level and they changed. They were looking at changes in the hemoglobin and they changed. But was this true and unrelated? And was actually being driven by one of the other ones, a little bit harder to, I mean, they tried to do that by showing which one was more correlated than the other, but I didn't think they could rule how that they were looking at effects that may not have been connected. So I thought it was, again, hypothesis generating. They talked about it being clinically useful, but they didn't describe how you would do this, particularly in this context of the 3 of them being related.
Good. Yeah. So let's do that. And I'll ask Mathis to chime in on that. So a couple of different things. One, Mathis, you mentioned already is that probably further studies are needed. So it'd be interesting your thoughts on, well, what might that look like? You're engaged in some of those already, but what other types of investigation are going to be needed to understand this a little bit more? And then I think, let's just say that all the subsequent data keeps looking something like this. It's a very complicated relationship. How would we actually make that something that clinicians could use? It's very complicated. And so even if you do measure all three of those, well, what do you do and what kind of rules do you follow to try to understand what you're targeting with testosterone treatment if you're measuring all three of those? So a couple of hard questions for you to end with us, and you can start with either of those.
Yeah. Well, as you said, it's complicated. And I agree with Rich, this study, they made the best out of the data they had. The study is hypothesis generating. So what you really want to do is to use this to design further studies where you dissect out individual roles of those different hormones. For example, you can use testosterone in conjunction with a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor to work out what DHT does and what does testosterone do, or you use studies with aromatase inhibitors where you dissect out the role of estradiol more specifically. Or the other study that we are doing, which I already mentioned, is where you use men with prostate cancer who receive androgen deprivation therapy, so they don't have testosterone nor estradiol, and then in an RCT context, you give estradiol at back, and therefore you can work out what estradiol directly does in the absence of testosterone. In terms of translating this into actionable clinical directives, this is very complicated. Part of this is that, as I pointed out, the authors use validated methodology to measure estradiol and DHT, and CDC quality controlled LCMS machines are, well, in US perhaps in some laboratories increasingly more used, but still on a global basis not available for clinicians for clinical decision making. So you don't really have accurate measures of these hormones in the first place. And even if you did, say, how would you adjust your testosterone preparation based on an estradiol concentration that would be too low? It would be very difficult to do this in clinical practice. And certainly there's no data to suggest that you should give testosterone in conjunction with estradiol or DHT. So it makes the clinical implications of this study, even allowing for the fact that it's hypothesis generating, quite difficult. I think overall, just on a broader context, I would like to mention again that while testosterone replacement for men with medical disease of the pituitary or the testes is uncontroversial, and testosterone replacement is indicated to treat men with organic hypogonadism, if you see an older man with slightly low testosterone who complains of androgen deficiency-like symptoms, the main clinical information that you get from this is that testosterone is a sensitive biomarker of poor health. And whether those men should be given testosterone treatment or not is, in an individual context, not always very clear. Clearly, before you consider testosterone treatment, you should address in a holistic manner associated comorbidities. For example, it is well known that weight loss can increase testosterone, and often normalized testosterone concentrations in men who have a slightly low testosterone, optimization of other comorbidities, sleep apnea, stopping offending medications where possible, especially opioids or glucocorticoids that reduce testosterone concentrations. And really only if all these lifestyle measures fail and the man is still symptomatic, then in the individualized context, by carefully explaining to the patient the pros and cons of testosterone therapy in a sort of shared decision-making process, you might sometimes use testosterone treatment as a trial of N equal ones to see whether they benefit or not. And if you do this, most of the symptoms that men complain about should normalize within 3 to 6 months of testosterone treatment. That's what the T trials showed.
And with that, I would like to thank Rich Comey and Mathis Grossman for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope you all learned as much as I did and that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.